This is Mountain Edition, all of this week's news from the Roaring Fork Valley, coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Zoe Rome, here with our summer production intern, Ryer Garden-Schwartz. Hi, Ryer.
Hi, Zoe. In the wake of the Lake Christine fire, the U.S. Forest Service released an analysis of how the fire could impact the landscape and watershed.
And I sit down with Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron to talk about environmental leadership.
And an interview with former EPA head Gina McCarthy.
The biggest stories from this week, coming up on Mountain Edition. The Garfield County Suicide Prevention Coalition organized a meeting to educate the public about mental health crises and to let people know that they're not alone. Mason Hostat, chairman of the coalition, says he hoped the meeting would be a starting point for dialogue.
To start having conversations about their mental health, start conversations about suicide prevention in their life, as well as get resources that are available to them.
Mental health resources are scarce in Western Colorado, but organizations like Hostats hope to fill in the gaps by teaching people things like how to call a crisis hotline for themselves or someone else. Additional information and resources are available through the Aspen Hope Center and MindSprings Health.
As containment grows on the Lake Christine fire, officials are considering next steps. Landscapes burned in wildfires can be more susceptible to flooding and debris flows during summer thunderstorms. Late last week, the U.S. Forest Service released its analysis of how the fire could impact the landscape and watershed. Elizabeth Stortsevery has details.
It's been a few weeks since the Lake Christine fire tore along the hillsides above Basalt and Elgibel. The flames are gone, but the evidence of the fire is clear on the blackened landscape. It's a haunting change from the usual green or gold slopes. Newspaper columnists have called this a hellscape. But seeing black after a fire is actually sort of a good sign.
As organic matter burns, black is kind of the first color you will see on a light burn. White's kind of intermediate. Red is when when the organic matter has burned a lot.
Beth Anderson is a soil scientist here as part of the U.S. Forest Service's Burn Area Emergency Response, or BEAR, team. This group includes hydrologists, engineers, biologists, and weed specialists. They assess the damage caused by wildfire and the likelihood of floods and mudslides that often follow.
One thing that we look at is soil structure.
We're standing on the south side of Basalt Mountain, where the fire burned on July 3rd and 4th. Anderson digs in the black dirt. In a healthy ecosystem, the soil and vegetation work together to absorb rainwater. When the grasses and plants are burned away and rain hits bare ground, it's up to the soil to deal with the water. If it's been badly burned, the soil isn't able to do its job very well. But here things look pretty good. When she breaks it apart, you can see roots that are still in place, and the soil stays in chunks.
So this right here, I would say this is definitely an unburned soil because it's still maintaining. There wasn't a lot of ash on the surface. The roots are still intact and the structure is still intact.
About a quarter of the burn saw low impacts like this. More than half of the soil was moderately burned, and a smaller percentage was severely impacted. Anderson points out each within a 3-foot circle, including some severely burned reddish soil under a scorched log.
And when I pick it up, it just kind of dissolves. There's not that structure.
This soil crumbles in her fingers, running through them like sand. These soils may repel water, causing it to run off instead of absorbing into the earth, and they account for about 12% of the burn area. Hydrologist and BEAR team lead Liz Schnackenberg explains.
It's almost like paving the watershed.
The BEAR team report says areas that have flooded before the fire will see an increase in magnitude and more frequent events. The U.S. Geological Survey created a map showing the probability of floods and mudslides in the burn area. It's up to 80% in some areas.
But I do think that this terrain will offset some of that. This is a very broken, kind of lumpy, bumpy landscape.
Schnackenberg says there's a lot of uncertainty in the USGS model, and it likely overestimates dangers, in part because of Basalt Mountain's unique topography. Instead of one or two major valleys coming down the hillside, there are a lot of little drainages, and many of them lead into flat meadows.
That can be a good thing because that means lots of little areas that water can settle out in, that sediment can be deposited in.
There are still areas of concern. The Bear Report recommends implementing an early warning system that can alert people if flooding or debris flows are likely during a major rain. But there are already signs of new life on Basalt Mountain. Beth Anderson points out fresh grasses and new oak brush.
You can already see that the vegetation is returning.
With some more rain, grasses and shrubs will likely come back in a couple of months. It'll take longer for the juniper trees to recover. The post-fire landscape is changed, certainly. But as Schnackenberg points out, the charred black will gradually turn to green.
It actually can be a really unique landscape and an opportunity to see that landscape reset itself, which, you know, fire is part of the natural ecology and part of the natural ecosystem.
And generally, she says, that landscape is able to recover. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Ryer Gardenswords. And Zoe, we know that people listening to Mountain Edition want to stay in the news.
Absolutely. And one of the ways you can do this is by checking out Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page to get updates on the latest news from across the valley.
You can interact with our station through comments on our posts or even message us directly.
Find us by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. Monday was the deadline for groups who wanted to get measures on the November election ballot to turn in signatures. One of those groups was Colorado Rising. They want to increase the setback distance between oil and gas drilling and residential development. KUNC's Matt Bloom has more on Initiative 97.
It's hard not to see the presence of the oil and gas industry in Colorado. It's grown over the years, just like the population, and it's why volunteers like Patricia Nelson spent a part of her summer collecting signatures.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Thank you for your time.
On a recent afternoon in Greeley, Nelson was making a last-minute push for Initiative 97.
It's to increase setbacks from populated or inhabited buildings, houses, daycare centers, schools.
From the current 500 feet from homes and 1,000 from schools to 2,500 feet, period. After politely listening to Nelson, local realtor Bill Hall doesn't sign the petition.
There's no need. The frack is happening over a mile and a half in the ground.
But a few minutes later, Vanessa Cruz eagerly takes the clipboard and adds her name. She lives within a half mile of four wells east of Greeley.
I know for sure that our water is not as safe as it used to be. We've had it tested on multiple accounts. I've had to put in water filtration devices.
In 2014, supporters of a constitutional amendment to increase setbacks called off their effort after Governor John Hickenlooper agreed to a panel to study the issue, along with the industry. 2 years later, backers failed to get enough signatures on a similar measure. And now, in 2018?
So it effectively will serve as a ban for oil and gas in the state of Colorado.
Tracy Bentley is head of the Colorado Petroleum Council, which is the state's division of the American Petroleum Institute. She says the effort is irresponsible, especially for an industry that employs more than 230,000 people in the state.
When you put it on a map and you set aside 2,500 feet from any occupied structure, it effectively does take 80% of the surface land off the table for oil and gas development.
But the lead organizer at Colorado Rising sees things differently. Outside of their Boulder office, Ann Lee Foster says this is not a ban on industry activity.
We're not isolating any minerals. We're asking for less than a half mile. It's really not that much.
With modern technology like horizontal drilling, she says a larger setback still allows the industry to do its job while keeping it away from homes and schools.
2,500 feet is based on a Colorado health study that showed that within a half mile, about 2,500 feet, the most grave health impacts occur. And also 2,500 feet is the standard evacuation radius that first responders use when they're there's a leak or an explosion, an incident at a well site.
Denver 7 has learned the remains of two people have been pulled from the rubble of this house explosion in Firestone.
Two other people inside that same home, they're in the hospital right
now. The Firestone explosion has changed a lot of people's opinion about the industry.
All of a sudden, the house shook and we heard a loud bang.
The home in the 2017 tragedy was built 200 feet away from an existing well that did not have a properly sealed flow line. However, Initiative 97 only addresses how close new wells could be built to homes, and not how close developers can build to existing wells.
We're doing this because we don't see any other option. We've tried to compromise, we've tried to collaborate, and they don't want to have discussions about basic health and safety measures.
Tracy Bentley acknowledges the concerns Colorado Rising has about health and safety, but she says implementing a blanket setback increase without consulting oil and gas companies would be problematic.
The vast majority of Coloradans understand the importance of our industry, and they want us here as long as we continue to develop responsibly. But a ban on oil and gas is not just bad for the industry. It's bad for consumers, and it's really bad for the economy.
It's why companies like Anadarko Petroleum have spent millions of dollars to defeat Initiative 97, even before it's fully known if it will go to voters. Colorado Rising needs over 98,000 signatures to make it on the ballot. They turned in more than 171,000. The Secretary of State's office has until September 5th to verify them. For KUNC, I'm Matt Bloom.
Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron sat on a panel called Change, Impact, and Action last week at the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies. They discussed what the changing climate means for recreation, agriculture, and local economies. He sat down with Zoe to talk more on the panel.
You are listening to Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Zoe Rome. I have on the line Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron. He sat on a panel hosted by Environment Colorado called Change, Impact, and Action that discussed what the changing climate means for recreation, agriculture, and local economies. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Zoe. Thanks for having me.
In this discussion, what was identified as the biggest hurdle in taking action against climate change?
In my opinion, the biggest hurdle is inaction at both state and national levels. And we've been successful because we've been active at a local level to prioritize what isn't getting done at those levels.
What about acting at the local level is more effective or different that's not being done at the state or national level?
It becomes a priority here. And because it's a priority, elected officials are able to enact legislation around policies that can address climate change.
So in this panel specifically, was there anything that people agreed on or disagreed on that is interesting and relevant to this conversation?
Generally the panel was in agreement with one another, and we all had our kind of general areas. I discussed issues around action at local level politics. Carrie Donovan, our state senator, discussed issues at the state level, and she touched on really important water issues. And the state of Colorado being identified as a leader. And Cooper Means, who from the Aspen Farm Collective, talked about the realities in farming and how climate change impacts issues he sees every day. And then Matt Hamilton from the ski company had a perspective from the corporate side. But fortunately, our kind of value sets are aligned with one another.
So Aspen is often discussed and literally is a upstream city from a lot of other places. What can we do that will affect other communities downstream, not just as a water leader, but in terms of policy and leadership?
Yeah, that's really important. I think that a place like Aspen should stand for something. And what it should stand for is being stewards of the environment, second to none. And while we ourselves aren't going to change, a small town like this one isn't going to change the climate issues ourselves, we can be identified, and we have, because what we do gets watched. So we can lead by example.
What is one example of a specific arena where Aspen is or could be a leader?
First of all, we spent 10 years, and we were able to convert our electric utility to run on 100% renewable sources. And it's an example of how a small town like this one can punch far above its weight and become an example for so many other places.
Right. And you touched on this when you mentioned the brand of the city having a lot of power and weight. But what else enables Aspen to be effective at promoting change in the environmental area?
our local economy depends on it. It's in our own interest. The strength of our local economy is directly tied to the health of our natural environment. Last summer was the first time when our summer tax receipts exceeded those of winter, and it's going to happen again this summer. That's quite significant for a ski town.
What was your biggest takeaway from this panel? What was something you learned or discovered?
I thought it was really valuable to hear the head of Local Farm Collective emphasize the need to address these issues. And then even more importantly, I valued that our largest private sector player in town shares the same concerns around these issues that the public sector does. I think that's a really valuable conversation.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Ryer Gardenswerth.
And I'm Zoe Rome. You can find us online at aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can find live broadcasts from the McCloskey Speaker Series, including tomorrow's Democratic Governor's Panel, Uniting a Divided Nation, Starting with the States.
This week's stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
The documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor screened Monday night at the Aspen Institute. The film focuses on the radical kindness of Fred Rogers, the unassuming star of the beloved television program Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay spoke with producer Nicholas Ma about Fred Rogers' legacy.
Nicholas Ma, thank you so much for speaking with me about Won't You Be My Neighbor. You appeared on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood twice, and those were also the only two times that you ever performed publicly with your father, cellist Yo-Yo Ma. What were those experiences like?
You know, I think the first time I went on the show, I was terribly intimidated by Fred, right? He has this, you know, this person who in two dimensions on a 10-inch screen somehow managed to steep into your brain and help develop your conscience. To see someone like that, you know, 6 feet tall and in 3D was unnerving. But at the same time, he's such a gentle soul, and his ability to bring you to a place where you can see yourself as his peer, even as a child, was just so extraordinary that I think after it got going, it felt like the most natural thing. And I was told by one of the producers that when I left, apparently I burst into tears because I felt like I was leaving my family. I think the second time I was on the show, it was quite the opposite. I think I was more intimidated about playing with my father. And I think Fred is probably the only person who could have convinced me that, in fact, that was not only something I wanted to do, but something that I would look back on with a lot of fondness as I got older.
So Mr. Rogers, that's kind of what I have to call him. I can't call him Fred Rogers. He was vulnerable, he was honest, and he made his guests vulnerable and honest. Is that an example or kind of an antidote to so much cynicism that we have that the world needs today?
He was able to turn vulnerability into a strength. By being that vulnerable, he commanded his audiences to respond with the same, not just children, but even as he got older and was doing college commencements, you know, there was a kind of strength in that vulnerability that I think in today's world we often lose sight of. We think to be vulnerable is to be weak, is to not stand up for oneself. But actually, vulnerability is arresting and powerful.
Nicholas, thank you so much for your time today and for making this film.
Oh, thank you so much.
On Tuesday night, Pickens County Commissioners met with Aspen City Council to discuss their intergovernmental agreement that dictates how the workforce housing program is run. Allison Bechtesh was at that meeting and sat down with Zoe to discuss what changes can be expected.
Allison Bechtesh was at that meeting and joins me now in the studio. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Zoe.
So this meeting was set up to talk about where the buck stops at the Aspen-Pitkin Housing Authority. Why even talk about changing the governance system?
Well, no one really thinks the current system is a breeze. We have an appointed citizen committee who acts as the board for the housing authority, but all of their work also needs to be approved by Aspen City Council and the Pickens County Board of County Commissioners, or the BOCC. You basically have 15 cooks in the kitchen with different levels of understanding of the housing system, different priorities, and when it comes to affordable housing, different budgets with which to pay for APSHA assets.
Okay, so last night in the commissioners and the council discussed one specific fix. What was that?
The idea on the table is that we keep this same representation, elected city members, elected county members, and then appointed citizens, but we reduce to just one decision-making entity, what Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron calls an empowered APSHA board. This proposal is the best possible solution according to a subcommittee that has been considering a variety of possible governance structures. The subcommittee was made up of some elected officials from city and county, as well as city and county staff. APSHA board members and APSHA staff were not there weighing in on the merits of any of the other proposals.
So was the APSHA board there last night?
They were, and they made it clear that they would have liked to be included sooner. Here's APSHA board member Chris Council, who pointed out that elected officials are welcome to be part of the current board meetings already.
You guys can already come to our meetings, and I would encourage you to. I haven't seen anybody there. I would ask the question, which one of our board members asked, when's the last time any elected official was able to attend a meeting?
Yeah, we don't have time.
Yeah, I know. I know you're joking, but I do think that's the answer.
So obviously there's some joking going on with Mayor Steve Skadron there, but his point is city council members get $20,000 a year to serve on the board. They all have other full-time jobs and twice weekly meeting requirements as it is. Are they really going to add this to their obligations? And Steve said, precisely, we have failed you as leaders. We haven't paid enough attention or given enough direction. So let's have just one board with absolute authority that is made up of elected officials. And that way objectives can be aligned around one single table.
How would that work exactly?
Okay, so a lot of the meeting last night was spent on the specific makeup of this empowered APSHA board. The proposal from the subcommittee is that there would be two representatives from council, two from commissioners, and three appointed citizens. Various other solutions were proposed, like maybe a five-member board instead of seven. But in general, the consensus among the elected officials was more elected officials voting on these matters, the better, because they're beholden to the public. If they mess up, they could get voted out of office. I didn't quite follow the logic that the community wouldn't want other community members representing them. And during public comment, several speakers did call these representatives out of touch. By far, most of the representatives do not live in affordable housing. Actually, County Commissioner candidate Kelly McNichols Curry, who is running unopposed, so she will join the BOCC this fall, she spoke just as a tenant of public housing.
Questions about governance should fundamentally be answered by those who are governed.
Here's the thing that struck me the most about the current proposed board composition. Something could get passed that even if an entire governing body is against that measure. And we have an example of this. A few years ago, there was a funding fix proposed by the city. Under our current system, the BOCC was able to shoot it down because they had that third of the voting power and that veto power. But under this new system, without anything changing to that exact proposal, the city council could now get that measure passed by their two representatives casting a yes vote, along with the two community members signing on. So the specific composition of the new board is one of the biggest questions still left unanswered.
So what are next steps here?
Okay, so it did seem like last night all 10 elected officials want some sort of super APSHA board instead of the current system. That would take a rewrite of the current intergovernmental agreement between Aspen and Pickens County. The commissioners were not ready to direct staff to rewrite that just yet. In 2 weeks, they have a retreat and they will discuss this further and bring their thoughts and questions back to council. In the meantime, staff will be creating a process to collect public comment on this proposal, and we know that the public will always have a lot to say.
This is reporter Allison Bektas joining me live in the studio this morning with a recap of the discussion between Aspen City Council and Pickens County Commissioners about the future management structure of the Workforce Housing Authority. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Zoe.
I'm Zoe Rome. This is Aspen Public Radio News.
Gina McCarthy is the director of the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at Harvard. She was the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency under President Obama. McCarthy was in town to give a lecture put on by the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies and spoke with reporter Wyatt Orm. They began their discussion talking about Scott Pruitt, Trump's first EPA administrator, who resigned in July. Pruitt came under scrutiny for ethics violations.
You penned an op-ed for the New York Times where you said, quote, he alone will decide what is and isn't acceptable science for the agency to use when developing policies that affect your health and the environment. Why does he have that kind of power?
Well, frankly, he shouldn't. Instead of looking at science and the law as we're supposed to, I think he had some particular outcomes in mind, and science became inconvenient to him. I don't want your listeners to think that he was successful because the things that we've talked about attacks on science, are still very much up in the air and will be very much in play through the court system and litigation. I don't want people to think that Scott Pruitt had the final decision on anything.
How confident are you that the EPA's achievements under President Obama will still be in place at the end of the Trump administration?
I'm pretty confident. I've seen the kind of rules that have been proposed so far, and they lack a level of professionalism that was expected when I was at EPA. You know, you saw a recent clean car rule come out that was attempting to get rid of the Obama-era clean car rules. The whole basis didn't make sense. I mean, in many ways, it was just if you make more fuel-efficient cars, there's going to somehow be a safety problem that's going to cause all kinds of havoc. They argued that people wouldn't buy these new fuel-efficient cars because they're too expensive to make, which we factually know is not correct. And then they argued, well, if they buy these new cars, then they're going to drive around more because they go further on a gallon of gasoline, which means statistically they're likely to get into an accident more often. How does any of that make any sense to any human being in the world? What's being talked about at the federal level is not representative of what the people in the United States understand to be happening. People here in Aspen, is anybody denying climate change? No. In places where you're so close to nature, you see changes very quickly.
Is it the government's job to protect citizens from climate change?
Yes, it is. Government's job is to make sure that people in this country can enjoy health and happiness.
This sort of leads me to the last question that I wanted to ask you. What is the greatest obstacle that the U.S. faces in lowering our emission and really fighting climate change as hard as we possibly can?
The only thing that I ever saw that really engaged and moved people was when their health was threatened and when their kids' health in particular was threatened. I'm there to try to explain to people that if they think climate change is just about people who live on the coastline or polar bears or snowmelt, they're wrong.
Yeah.
It's about impacts that every family in the United States is facing today and will continue to face. So if we can make those connections, if we can personalize the issue of climate change, we can broaden the engagement to a level we need to actually have the energy and the enthusiasm we need to be leaders again. Let's put on our big boy, big girl, agenda-neutral pants and just get moving. That's what I want.
Gina McCarthy is the director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard University. She's the former administrator of the EPA under President Obama. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Ryer Gardenswartz. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in to Aspen Public Radio tomorrow at 3 for a live broadcast from the McCloskey Speaker Series, featuring a Democratic governor's panel on how to unite a divided nation, starting with the states.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.